Hi, I'm Cassie McCullough and welcome to The List, RN's weekly briefing on all things popular culture and TV. Today, how do you discover new stuff to watch? The first major study of our online and on-demand viewing habits reveals the number one way is word of mouth from family and friends. But we're watching alone. Don't wanna be all by myself. Also, Mars One, the plan to send volunteer astronauts on a one-way journey to Mars, a reality show that's literally out of this world, or a Martian fantasy based on untested science. Yes, it does seem that once again the world is obsessed with space travel, the comet landing, the troubled Virgin Galactic project, even the movies, Interstellar, Gravity, reflect a kind of fascination. But the ambition of the Mars One project is audacious. How much of it is science and how much is pop cultural obsession and marketing gold dust? A little later we'll speak to journalist Elmo Keep, who's been taking a closer look. But first, it's hello to List producer Wendy Zukerman. And Wendy, the week belonged to Sir Bob Geldof, or did it?
Well, Bob Geldof created a number one hit single, Do They Know It's Christmas? He was raising money for Ebola and did a very good job at it, raising over £1 million in 5 minutes.
That's pounds.
That's a lot of cash. And it also created a big firestorm with people calling the hit single another example of patronising, colonialism, treating Africa as if it is a charity case that needs help, and also portraying the Ebola virus as a disease which has enraptured all of Africa when really it's just a very small portion of the massive continent.
Yeah, there were some familiar faces from the original Band-Aid song from 30 years ago. Bono was there. And interestingly, he changed his famous lyric from the original, and tonight, thank God it's them instead of you. He's changed it to something a little less controversial. Well, tonight we'll reach in out
and touching you. Oh, yes.
I was quite taken when I saw the video that everyone's still got one hand on their headphones.
Oh, yeah. Well, I don't think you can care about a cause while you're singing it unless you've got one hand on your headphones. As if he couldn't have picked a better song, because all those years ago, his campaign also courted controversy, and it's no surprise. Why would you choose a song that has such a Christian bent?
Yeah, there's been all kinds of commentary right around the world, some people saying that it's got a missionary flavour, that it confuses the message. The campaigner Salome Leme, who is the head of Africa Responds, says that while it's well-intentioned, Africa took a long, long time to recover from the Band-Aid project, which portrayed Africa as relying on more developed nations and not being able to stand on its own two feet.
And in fact, these criticisms were put to Bob Geldof during a Sky News interview. The journalist in question was quoting UK journalist Ian Birrell when she brought out these criticisms.
He says this trite song will raise a comparative pittance, ignores Africans and has a logo implying the virus struck the entire continent, patronising and perpetuating myths again. Band-Aid should have learned its lessons and stayed silent. What would be your response to that?
Complete load.
Yes.
What did he say?
Poetic and wondrous response.
It was bollocks, wasn't it?
It was bollocks. Yeah, and you know, some of the criticisms online have taken it even one step further, saying the real reason that Ebola is spreading is because of capitalism and the world order that we have at the moment. Now, while that might be somewhat true, I don't think we can wait for the revolution before we do start raising money for Ebola and helping the individuals that are affected. So while I think that Bob Geldof could easily have picked a better song with better lyrics, could have involved some African musicians, at least he's doing something.
Yeah, well, look, my feeling is that he's doing more than I am, but I think at the same time it is a very antiquated notion.
And there is another song out that was actually released before Bob Geldof's called Africa Stop Ebola, and this was created by a collective of African musicians.
Tout le monde est en danger, les jeunes et les anciens. Il faut agir pour nos familles.
It sounds a hell of a lot better, I've got to say.
I agree with you on that.
For a final piece of news, we've got a little bit of a quiz for you, Cassie.
Oh, yeah.
I'm going to read some poetry that was from a published book that happened upon Guardian Australia's desk this week, and it was written by a current Australian politician who wrote it when they were 26 years old. Who do you think wrote these poetic words? I'm old now. Once I was beautiful, once I was sought after, once I had diamonds, once I had gold, once I had love, but now I am old. Which politician wrote those words when they were 26?
Well, I'm going to guess Clive Palmer.
You would be right. You would be right. Now, Guardian Australia, to their credit, did not want to poetry bash these words. And so they actually gave it to Sir Bob Geldof to have a listen to, and this is what he said it sounded like.
Complete load.
I don't think that's true. Do we have another Max Harris in our midst? On RN, this is The List, and I'm Cassie McCullough. Now, this week, the US-based Netflix announced it'll launch an Australian arm in March. The long-anticipated move by the subscription video-on-demand giant is said to be a game-changer for the Australian television industry. But with details yet to emerge, the jury is still out on whether it's a good thing for the development of local content. Some say it will drive competitive pricing and expand audiences, leading to more compelling Australian content. Others think it's a body blow for the traditional broadcast TV model. One thing's for certain, our viewing habits are already evolving fast. This week, the government-funded agency Screen Australia released the first ever major survey of our viewing behaviour, and it shows the audience shift has already occurred. CEO Graham Mason presented the report, Online and On Demand, Trends in Australian Video Use, at this week's Screen Producers Association conference in Melbourne. Graham, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome, Cassie. Good to be here.
One of the things that stuck out in your report is that people are still getting their recommendations for things to watch from word of mouth, from family and friends. Did this surprise you?
It really did. It was one of the key things, actually, that, you know, sort of really took us by surprise. You've got people using all manner of new content and information and means of screening and viewing stuff, but they still rely on buddies and mums telling them what they thought of the show. It's also quite interesting that one of the things that survey also showed was that we're watching content a lot more on our own, but sharing that information to others. And sometimes that's, you know, new methods, he says, laughing. I mean, like Twitter and stuff. I guess what we're interested in is that there's complementary between new and old here, both in what people are watching and also how they're talking about it to each other.
Well, let's have a look at some of the main findings of the study. You're surprised by the spread of people viewing on internet-connected devices.
Yeah, that's right. It isn't just, you know, young guys with beards and skinny jeans hanging out in urban areas. It's mums, it's dads, it's empty nesters, it's everybody. You know, as we say in the business, it's all four quadrants. So it's the whole, you know, possible demographic is using online. And again, every sort of socioeconomic group, whether they're students or retirees, it's across the board.
So when we say viewing online, more specifically, what do we mean by that?
Okay, yeah, it's catch-up TV is the most popular by far, and whether it be iView or SBS On Demand, Plus 7, 9 Jump In, 10 Play, I mean, they've all got it. There's also ad-supported services like YouTube, or the subscription, you know, video on demand services where you've got QuickFlix or Fetch TV or Foxtel's Presto. And then the last one is where it's paid, where you might do an online rental or download to own, like via iTunes.
So why is it attractive to Australians?
I think what we're finding is that we're all really time poor. Mm-hmm. And that's because there's so much choice now. You know, back when, you know, I was a kid and watching telly, there was a couple of channels and, you know, you waited to see the movies in your school holidays. Whereas you think, in just 10 short years, you've had YouTube only began in 2005 and catch-up iView only started in 2008. But every day there's new means of seeing stuff and thousands more things to possibly watch. And so what we do is we try and put it in around our own lives.
Yeah, I guess that explains the solo viewing figures being so high, that it is no longer appointment television where a share household or a family gets together to watch something. What about legal versus illegal?
The vast majority are legitimate or use legitimate and illegitimate platforms together. Obviously, it's a major concern for all of us, and we understand that some people say the biggest barrier for them is they want it when they want it, they don't want to wait. I guess what we're hopeful of is that people understand if we can shorten down windows and get the stuff available, we really need them to pay, because this is like, otherwise it's like taking something out of a shop.
You wouldn't download a pizza.
Correct. Really, I mean, as someone who's responsible for the screen industry as a whole here in Australia, what I really worry about is all the people who've worked on a film or a TV show. They really need their work to be safeguarded and looked after.
Yeah, of course. And there is also the counter-argument that if the delivery systems were easy, cheap, convenient, then people would probably use them over illegal piracy.
Yeah, I mean, and that's what we're hoping. And because one of the things is, in the survey, again, it does show that people found slow connections really problematic, and that the better your broadband connection is, the more likely you are to pay for the content.
Now, onto the juicy stuff. What are people watching? Because broadcast television and cinema are still doing well.
At the moment, we still see that broadcast TV is the prime way that people consume content. And similarly, cinema attendance is still very strong and DVD is still strong. But what we were very interested in, again, is that people were watching Australian content. Australian drama was neck and neck with foreign US-led drama. Again, a surprise. I think many people have heard that everyone's watching Breaking Bad or Game of Thrones and downloading them and gorging themselves on it.
Now, that's probably very heartening to many in the industry, because the fear's always been that once you had ready access to, I don't know, Scandinavian noir or French paranormal series, that we'd all be downloading those. But if there is a hunger for Australian stories on video on demand, then surely that can translate into a viable industry continuing.
Yeah, I mean, we'd really hope so. And obviously what it does do is it gives some oxygen to those formats which are slightly harder for people to see. I mean, one that springs to mind is horror or genre films and telly shows that traditionally just have not worked very well in the cinema here in Australia. But what we're seeing here is that people will search for that online and they'll pay for it. So we'd hope, as these services continue to roll out and speeds improve and distribution gets slicker, that there could be more choice available to people. Documentaries also, interestingly, play better on demand than they do on telly or in the cinema, and different ones so than you would think. So things like science and environmental are really strong online, much stronger than they are in other means of distribution. But there is a downside to all this, though, at the moment, that most people we surveyed, whilst if speeds and delivery were good, they'd pay, they're not very keen to pay a lot. So there's a reticence to pay sort of market rate.
Now, what about the next generation of things we're going to see? You've been at the Screen Forever conference this week.
I think the big thing that we're looking at is different means of making content. And particularly, we're looking for new content makers. And I don't necessarily mean young, I just mean new, because some of the most exciting stuff we're seeing is coming out of people in their mid or even older age groups. But there was one thing that we did recently called Skip Ahead, and it was getting a hold of people who were doing content or their own channels on YouTube and sort of uploading it themselves to it. And we sort of gave them some money to try and help flesh that out into slightly longer content or perhaps a little bit more professionally produced. And some of those things have gone on now to longer formats. There's one which went on to iView, commissioned directly to iView, called Wastelander Panda, and it's going to end up on ABC 2. We've had other ones which ended up with more than 1 million subscribers on their YouTube channels. And for some of the viewers who don't potentially look at that sort of content, it's fascinating to realise that there is a whole generation of content creators who are making stuff in a very different way, sharing it in a different way, who don't see telly or film as their end game. They see their YouTube content as an end in itself.
So a great democratisation.
Yeah, I mean, and it's really interesting when, I mean, as I say, you know, there's some of these people with 1 million subscribers. These are people who are paying to be members of that crowd, or 150 million views. Now, that's really just extraordinary numbers.
So you're confident, you're feeling, I guess I wonder, it's impossible from a legislative viewpoint to in any way ensure Australian content is making up any percentage of online offers, because it's so wide and ungovernable, really, from that point of view.
No, I mean, it's something that many countries around the world are struggling with, because obviously we love the fact that there's this freedom for people to create and share and consume content from anywhere. But at the same time, agencies like us are in most countries of the world except the US. And what we're trying to do is ensure that Australian voices are heard and stories are told. And it is tricky to work out how that will continue, because at the moment we have quotas on television to ensure that there's children's programming, that there is Australian drama and Australian voices. But if that's not on the internet, which of course you can understand why it's not, if it's meant to be no barriers, it puts all of us in an interesting place going forward.
Graham Mason, thanks for joining us.
Thanks very much.
Graham Mason is the CEO of Screen Australia, and he presented the first major profile of Australia's audience for video on demand at the Screen Producers Association conference in Melbourne this week.
Since the world began, ever inventive man has constantly pushed forward into the unknown.
6 billion people are watching as 4 Americans set foot on the planet Mars and vanish.
That's what made him come to Mars.
Without a trace.
Welcome to Mars.
That's a Martian?
That's
close. My God.
Well, I should think it would be terrifying. I know enough about rocket propulsion to believe there's an outside chance you'll make it there. But aren't you worried about getting back?
The idea of travelling to Mars has been a pop culture obsession for decades. But for the last couple of years, some people are saying it could be a reality as well. Mars One is a privately run Dutch project which has been calling for volunteers to make a one-way journey to the Red Planet and settle there.
Mars One will establish human settlement on Mars in 2023.
The billion-dollar mission is supposedly to be funded by the sale of international TV rights, a reality show that's literally out of this world, Big Brother at the final frontier.
This is going to be a media spectacle. Big Brother will pale in comparison. The whole world will be watching and experience this journey.
The plan has been making global headlines since it was announced in 2012. And right now, Mars One is selling the broadcasting rights for interviews with the 663 candidate astronauts for the mission, including some Australians. But not everyone is convinced the mission will get off the ground. Is it a scientific endeavour or a delusion on a grand scale? Elmo Keep is a freelance technology journalist based in Alice Springs, and she's been following the would-be Martian adventure for more than a year. Hi Elmo, and welcome to The List.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Now, Buzz Lansdorp, the CEO of the Mars One mission, told the New York Times that this will be one of the biggest events in human history. What exactly is the plan?
Okay, so the plan is, as they outline it, is that they are going to be able to raise billions of dollars through creating this enormous entertainment property in the form of this reality TV show. And so they're anticipating that they're going to get around $6 billion of advertising broadcast rights through the creation of this show.
What exactly are the volunteer astronauts going to do?
The long-term goal is to colonize the surface of Mars with a human settlement. It's to send people, four of them at first, and they're going to be the first colonists who are going to land there. They're going to, in the lead up, spend 10 years training in analogs on Earth and being supposedly trained up in how to be an astronaut. And so once they have selected these people, once the technology has been invented by other companies, they're then going to buy that technology, like with the money that's been made from selling the broadcast rights, and then they'll be able to buy the tech, and then they'll be able to send them, and then they'll be able to film them. So you can sort of see how things are a little bit around the wrong way there.
Well, I can hear that you're bemused by it, and it does seem out of this world. But this is part of how the moon landings worked, a little bit in reverse, I suppose, but it was a collaboration between private industry and government money.
Yes, except so in this instance, they are completely divorced from government, and that's how they see being able to do what they want to do. No government agency ever will be able to send people, their citizens, into space to die there without a way to get them back.
How seriously is this project being taken by, well, the media and other space agencies like NASA?
Well, there's a lot of different feeling inside NASA about it. There are astronauts who are incredibly hostile towards it because they know what becoming an astronaut actually takes. And there are other people inside NASA who cautiously are excited about it because the thing that matters the most to them is that people care about space exploration.
So in the course of writing about it, you actually interviewed Chris Hadfield, the rock star astronaut. What did he have to say?
He is just incredibly, incredibly skilled, and he does not think that Mars One is a plan that will work at all. He does believe that inevitably the people who are working in space agencies will get to Mars at some point in the future on the much more realistic NASA roadmap, which is decades from now.
You also have some pretty big reservations about the viability of the project. What are they?
I'd gone into this story wanting to just know the truth of it, but the further I looked into it, the less convinced I became, and they weren't able to convince me otherwise.
What are some of the really obvious flaws in the plan so far?
There is no vehicle that exists yet that could take anyone that far. When you don't know the vehicle dimensions, you can't start to pick a crew who's going to go on the mission. There is so far not the materials that have been invented yet that would be able to be used for a suit that could withstand the radiation environment on Mars over a long period of time. You would have to be repairing everything all the time. There is no... What would they eat? They would need to grow plant-based foods, which would create a deadly environment of a too high nitrogen and oxygen ratio, which is going to create a fire hazard. There's no way that they can take enough food for life, so they're going to have to be resupplied. Where is the money going to come from for these constant resupply missions? That's actually the biggest hole in their plan. This $6 billion cost that they have, which is in itself quite unreasonable, that's only to get people there.
And
that's
it. Mars itself is very inhospitable, I believe.
Yes, it has no atmosphere. The sun is massively further away. It's minus 62 Celsius. That's its average. So it's absolutely frozen, barren, dead planet.
But from what I've read, a lot of the people who volunteered to be astronauts are quite happy with the idea that it's more or less a short-lived venture they're going on.
Which raises a really interesting question psychometrically, which is if someone is willing to die in space on a mission, are they psychologically capable of undertaking it in the first place? So if you look at just purely the psychological side of what they would have to withstand, which is actually how I started the story. A couple of years ago, there was a piece in The Guardian, very short piece, that a psychologist had written where he had listed off the 10 most corrosive things that would happen to them mentally. And he was saying, even if just one of these things happened to a person who I treated, they would be in acute psychological distress. These people are going to have a combination of almost all of these things, you know, isolation being the worst, the hallucinations that they would undergo.
And there's so, just the chance that you might end up in the capsule with a jerk.
Yeah.
Well, someone that you can't stand.
Or not knowing how they would react to the hard reality of not coming back.
Mm.
There's no way to be able to model that. There is no way to model how human mind will cope with leaving this planet forever and not being able to come back. There's literally no way to replicate that, because no matter how long you're isolated for, you know you're going to get out of the isolation analog. You know that on a part of, on a level of your thinking. That's gone, obviously, when you go one way into space. And there's no way to know how people will cope with that.
We're talking with Elmo Keep, who's a freelance technology journalist who's been following the Mars One project, which has been around for a couple of years but still going strong. You actually tracked down one of the Australian volunteer astronauts. How's it already changed his life?
For Josh, he is just so passionate about science and so passionate about space, and is someone who has no option. If you're an Australian, you have no hope of joining a spacefaring agency. That we have no contract with anyone. There's no way. You can't now, because Andy Thomas, who's our only astronaut, he became an American citizen, which they now forbid you to do if you want to become an astronaut. They're like, you cannot do that. So for him, this is like the longest shot in the world. But for him, he couldn't live with himself if he didn't give it a go. So that's where he comes from in this. And he gets to go out to high schools and to primary schools and talk to kids about science because his background is in physics. And for him, it's just given him a whole lot of opportunities here on Earth that he wouldn't have had otherwise.
So he's going out and talking to Australian school kids as a representative of Mars One.
Yeah, to an extent. He brands himself as someone who is on the short list, but also as a science communicator, a science educator, and that's really his driving passion.
And what's the personal toll on his family and friends?
He made a lot of sacrifices. He ended a relationship that he was very happily in with a girl who was also very happily in it with him. And when it was evident to her and to him how serious he was about committing to it, he decided to end their relationship because he didn't think it was fair.
What do his parents think?
His parents are cautiously excited, I think is how I would put it. They're enormously proud of him. They're very proud of him. But they also know, wow, this is a wild thing that our son is involved in. But he gets a great sense of purpose from it, great sense of achievement from it. So it's made him a happier person.
So in the sort of macro vision of this, do you think it is a kind of, you know, meeting of reality television obsession with our obsession with space exploration? Is it a sort of mass delusion?
I think it's a profound misunderstanding of the power of media. If you wanted to make the world's biggest entertainment property and generate $6 billion in profit from a TV show, that's bigger than Avatar, Titanic and the Avengers takings from box office combined. So that's how big an entertainment property you have to create. We're not in a media environment where things like that come around.
Well, Elmo Keep, you'll be watching this for some time yet, it seems.
I will.
Thanks for talking to us.
Thanks for having me. Thank you so much.
That's Elmo Keep. She's a technology journalist, freelancer. She's based in Alice Springs and she's been following the Mars One mission, as you can tell, with a lot of interest.
How do you react when your husband says, guess what, it's one way, I'm not coming back?
The sky's the limit. But I guess it's actually more than the sky that's the limit.
I really want to do this. I want to go to Mars. I want this more than I want anything.
Well, that's it for The List today. I'm Cassie McCullough. See you next week.
Hi, it's Michael Cathcart here with another week of sparkling stories from Books and Arts Daily. You'll meet playwright Joanna Murray-Smith, essayist Robert Desay, poet Les Murray, and that flamboyant Aussie art critic Patrick McCackie, and lots of issues. Should fashion be on show and art galleries? Pop artist Jeff Koons, why does anyone take him seriously, and the place of drama in the national curriculum? That's Books and Arts. You can download us from the RN website.